78. The Professional Party Secretary. In the early days of Marfino, their trade union had great moral significance in the lives of the Institute's free employees. Everyone knows that a trade union could be a key factor in socialist production. It alone could selflessly request the government to make the working day and the working week longer, to raise production norms and lower wages. If people in towns had nothing to eat or nowhere to live, or, as so often, neither of those things, the trade union, who else, would come to the rescue, authorizing its members to cultivate collective holdings on their days off and build houses for the state in their leisure hours. The trade unions were the foundation on which all the conquests of the revolution and the ever firmer position of the boss class rested. A general meeting of the trade union members was the best place to demand the dismissal of a fellow worker guilty of complaining or demanding his rights, if the management dared not dismiss him otherwise. When work property was written off as of no further use to the state, but was still usable by the director on the domestic level, no signature could look so spotlessly pure on the necessary document as that of the local TU secretary. Moreover, the trade unions paid for themselves, with the 30th percentage point that the state could not very well withhold from the worker's wage, in addition to the 29% deducted to cover tax and a voluntary contribution to the state loan. In matters great and small, the trade unions became, day in and day out, a veritable school of communism. In spite of which, the Marfino Institute's trade union was suppressed. A highly placed comrade in the Moscow City Party Committee had gotten wind of its existence and been horrified. "What are you thinking of?" he had gasped, without even adding the word comrades. "This smacks of Trotskyism. Marfino is a military establishment. What's it doing with a trade union?" The union was abolished the very same day. Life at Marfino was not, however, shaken to its foundations. The only result was that the importance of the party organization, not inconsiderable before, grew and grew. The Oblast Committee of the party recognized Marfino's need for a full-time party secretary. After scrutinizing a number of dossiers submitted by the personnel department, the bureau decided to recommend Stepanov Boris Sergeyevich, born 1900, native of the village of Lupachi, rural district of Bobrovsk. Social origin, family of farm laborers after the revolution policeman, no professional qualifications. Present social position, office worker. Education, 4 years elementary school, plus 2 year training school. Party member from 1921, engaged in party work from 1923. No deviations from the party line. Took no part in opposition groups. Has not served in armed forces or institutions of white government. Has not lived under enemy occupation. Has not been abroad. Knows no languages. Does not know the languages of any non-Russian peoples of the USSR. Suffers from shell shock. Has Order of Red Banner and Medal for victory over Germany in the Fatherland War. When the Abkom made its recommendations, Stepanov was away in the Volokolamsk district, engaged as an agitator in the harvest campaign. If the collective farmers sat down to eat or simply for a smoke, he took advantage of every leisure minute to make them gather around, or in the evenings summon them to the kolkhoz office, so that he could tirelessly explain, in the light of the world-conquering doctrine of Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, how important it was that the land should be sown every year with good quality seed, that the yield should be as much in excess of the seed sown as possible, and that the crop should be harvested without wastage or pilfering, and handed over with all possible speed to the state. Foregoing rest, he moved on to the tractor drivers and explained to them, in the light of the same immortal doctrine, the importance of economizing on fuel, the need to take good care of equipment, the utter inadmissibility of standstills. He also, reluctantly, answered questions about poor maintenance work and the unavailability of overalls. Meanwhile, a general meeting of the Marfino Party organization had enthusiastically accepted the recommendation of the Abkom and elected Stepanov, sight unseen, full-time secretary. A co-op official in the Yegorov district, relieved of his post for embezzlement, was sent to agitate in Volokolamsk While in Marfino, an office next to that of the secret operations officer was fitted out for Stepanov, and he assumed control. He began by formally taking over from his part-time predecessor, Lieutenant Klikachev. Klikachev was as lean as a wolfhound, quick on his feet, and tireless. He ran the code-cracking lab, supervised the cryptographic and statistical groups, presided over the Komsomol seminar, was the moving spirit of the youth group, and had still found time to act as secretary to the party committee. And although his superiors considered Klikachev rigorous, while his subordinates called him a nitpicker, the new secretary at once suspected that party business in the Marfino Institute had been neglected. For party work demands the whole man, with nothing left over for other activities. It was as he had expected. The takeover occupied a whole week, during which Stepanov did not once leave his office. He perused every document in the place and got to know every party member, from his or her dossier first, and only then in the flesh. The new secretary's hand weighed heavily on Klikachev. One dereliction after another came to light. Unanswered questionnaires, defective personnel files, failure to provide detailed assessments of the character and performance of each member and candidate member. The same fatal flaw vitiated all of the previous secretary's initiatives. Nothing that he undertook was adequately documented, and so those activities themselves appeared spectral.
Who's going to believe it? Who's going to take your word for it that these measures really were implemented?
Stepanov exclaimed, holding a smoking cigarette above his bald head. He explained patiently that Klikachev's activities existed only on paper, since his word was the only evidence for them, and not in reality, meaning not on paper, not in the form of official reports. Who cares, for instance, whether or not the Institute's physiculturists, he was talking about prisoners, of course, play enthusiastic volleyball in the lunch hour, and even make a habit of running over into working time? Maybe they do. Neither you nor I nor anybody else will be going down to the yard to see whether the ball really is in the air. But if they've played so often and accumulated so much experience, shouldn't they share it with others in a special physical culture walled newspaper called, say, Red Ball? If Klikachev then took the paper down regularly and filed it in party records, no inspection team could doubt for a moment that Operation Volleyball was a reality carried out under party supervision. As things were, who would take Klikachev's word for it? And so it went on and on. You can't file the spoken word, was the profound dictum with which Stepanov took up his duties. A Catholic priest would not believe that anyone could lie in the confessional, and it would never enter Stepanov's head that lies can be told even in written records. Skinny Klikachev, with his chronic wheeze, did not argue with Stepanov, but feigned grateful agreement and followed his example. While Stepanov soon softened toward Klikachev, thus demonstrating that there was no malice in him, he listened intently to Klikachev's misgivings about Engineer Colonel Yakonov. Should an important research institute have at its head someone with such a dubious record, someone who was quite simply not one of us? Stepanov was already very much on his guard. He now made Klikachev his right-hand man, told him to drop in at the party office whenever he felt like it, and good-naturedly shared with him the treasures of his own party experience. So Klikachev got to know the new party organizer sooner and better than anyone. The Young, adopted his sarcastic nickname for Stepanov, the Shepherd. But it was thanks to Klikachev that relations between Stepanov and the Young were not as bad as they might have been. The Young were quick to realize that it made life much easier if the party organizer was obviously not their man, but an impartial stickler for rules and regulations. And what a stickler Stepanov was! Tell him that someone was to be pitied, that someone should be spared the full rigor of the law and shown clemency, and his brow, loftier since his hair had receded, would crease in pain, and his shoulders slump as if an additional burden had been laid on them. Until, fired by the ardor of his faith, he found the strength to rise to his full height and turn on interlocutors right and left so sharply that little white squares, reflections of the windows, flashed in the leaden lenses of his spectacles.
"Comrades, comrades, what is this I hear? How can you talk that way? Remember, you must uphold the law at all times. Uphold the law, however hard you find it. Uphold the law with all your might. Only thus, only in this way, can you really help the person for whose sake you came close to breaking the law. Because the law is devised to serve society and mankind, though we often fail to realize this, and in our own blindness seek to circumvent the law."
Stepanov, for his part, was pleased with the young, who showed a taste for party meetings and party criticism. He saw in them the nucleus of a sound collective, such as he always tried to create at each new place of work. The collective that failed to expose lawbreakers in its midst, the collective that sat mum through meetings, was a collective that Stepanov rightly considered unsound. Whereas if a collective, to a man, fell upon one of its members, the very one at whom the party committee had pointed a finger, that collective was, in the eyes of Stepanov and those above him, a sound one. Stepanov had many similar ideas, so firmly fixed in his mind that any departure from them was impossible. He could not, for instance, imagine a meeting that did not end with a tumultuous resolution castigating individual members and mobilizing the collective as a whole to break production records. He was particularly fond of open party meetings, which non-party people also attended on a voluntary, compulsory basis, only to be torn to shreds with no right to defend themselves or to vote. If, before the vote was taken, pained or even indignant voices were heard asking, "What is this, a party meeting or a criminal court?" Stepanov would peremptorily interrupt whoever was speaking, even the chairman, sprinkling a sedative powder on his tongue with a shaky hand. Since his shell shock, excitement made his head ache, and he always got agitated when the party's infallibility was under attack. He would walk into the middle of the room, directly under the ceiling lights, so that the large beads of sweat on his bald brow stood out, and say, "Are we to take it, then, that you are against criticism and self-criticism?" Then, emphatically flourishing his clenched fist as if hammering his thoughts into the heads of his listeners, he would explain that self-criticism is the supreme dynamic law of Soviet society, the main engine of its progress. It is time you understood that when we criticize members of our collective, it is not with a view to putting them on trial, but to keep every member of staff in a state of creative tension every minute of the day. About this, there cannot be two opinions, comrades. Of course, not every kind of criticism is needed. What we need is business-like criticism, meaning criticism that is not directed at tried and tested leading cadres. We must not confuse freedom to criticize with the freedom of petty bourgeois anarchism." With which he withdrew to the carafe and washed down another powder with a swig of water. Thus was the triumph of the party's general line ensured, and the result was always that a sound collective, including members scourged and crushed by the resolution, condemning their criminally slack attitude to their work, and their failure to meet completion dates bordering on sabotage, unanimously voted for it. It sometimes happened that Stepanov, though so fond of extended and closely argued resolutions, and though happily aware in advance of the line that speakers could be expected to take and the final verdict of the meeting, was short of time to draft a resolution in full beforehand. On such occasions, when the chairman called on Comrade Stepanov to present the draft resolution, he would mop his brow and bald patch and speak as follows. "Comrades, I have been very busy and have not had time to check certain circumstances, names, and facts." Or, "Comrades, the directorate sent for me today, and I have not yet been able to draft a resolution." In either case, he would add, "I ask you therefore to vote on a resolution in general terms, and I will attend to the details tomorrow, when I have time." And the Marfino Collective proved its soundness by raising its hands without a murmur, although it did not know, and did not ask, who exactly was to be lashed, and who lauded in that resolution. The new party organizer's position was further reinforced by his avoidance of intimate relationships. Everyone addressed him respectfully as Boris Sergeyevich. He accepted this as his due, but did not himself call anyone at the site by his first name and patronymic. Even in the heat of a desktop billiards match, the green baize was always in evidence in the party committee's room, he would exclaim, "Put the balls up, Comrade Shekin," or "Off the rail, Comrade Klikachov." Stepanov did not much like people appealing to his better nature. He himself never appealed to anyone's finer feelings. So that the moment he sensed dissatisfaction in the collective or resistance to his initiatives, instead of loud remonstrances or quiet permission, he took a large sheet of blank paper, wrote at the top in bold letters, "The below-mentioned comrades are required by such and such a date to do this, that, and the other," then ruled columns for "recipient's name, serial number, and acknowledgement of receipt," and handed it to his secretary to take around. The comrades indicated read it, sputtered their fury over an impervious sheet of paper, and had no choice but to sign, and, having signed, to do as they were bidden. Stepanov's release from other duties was also release from wandering in the dark. The radio had only to announce that heroic Yugoslavia no longer existed, only the Tito clique, and within 5 minutes Stepanov would be explaining the Comintern resolution as cogently and confidently as if he personally had been pondering it for years. If anyone timidly called Stepanov's attention to a contradiction between yesterday's and today's instructions, to gaps in the Institute's equipment, to the inferiority of Soviet apparatus, to difficulties with living accommodations, the liberated Stepanov simply smiled and his glasses gleamed, because whoever it was must surely know what he was about to say. "Well, what can we do about it, comrades? It's a departmental muddle. But progress is undoubtedly being made, with this problem as with others. You won't deny that, I'm sure." Stepanov did have certain human weaknesses, though not very important ones. He liked being praised by his superiors, for instance, and being admired by ordinary party members as an experienced leader. He enjoyed these tributes because they were no more than his due. He was also fond of vodka, but only if someone treated him, or if it was served at a banquet, and he invariably complained, as he drank, that vodka was murder to one in his state of health, which was why he never bought it himself, or treated anyone else. These were perhaps his only faults. The young sometimes argued among themselves as to how the shepherd should best be described. "My friends," Reutemann said, "he is the prophet of the bottomless inkwell. He is the soul of the rubber-stamped document. Such people are an inevitable feature of the transition period." But Klikachov bared his teeth in a grin and said, "Simpletons, if we get within biting distance, he'll gobble us up, shit and all. Don't think he's stupid. He's learned what it's all about in his 50 years. Why do you think every meeting adopts a motion tearing someone to pieces? He's waiting for the history of Marfino, that's why. He's storing up scraps of evidence just in case. Whatever turn things take, any inspection team will be convinced that the full-time secretary gave repeated warnings and did his best to alert the public." The treacherous Klikachov depicted Stepanov as a devious intriguer who would stop at nothing to give his 3 sons a good start in life. Stepanov did indeed have 3 sons, who were forever asking their father for money. He had steered all 3 toward the history department, knowing that for Marxists, history is not a difficult discipline. His calculation looked sound enough, but he, like the state's general education plan, had failed to allow for a sudden glut of Marxist historians. Supply greatly exceeded demand from schools, colleges, crash courses, exceeded demand in Moscow itself, then throughout the Moscow Oblast, and finally everywhere this side of the Urals. When the first son graduated, instead of staying at home to support his parents, he left for far-off Khanty-Mansiysk. The second son was offered a post in Mongolia, and it seemed doubtful whether, when the third son finished his studies, he would find anything nearer than the island of Borneo. Their father clung all the more tenaciously to his job and his little house on the outskirts of Moscow, with his 0.12 hectares of garden, his barrels of sauerkraut, and his 2 or 3 porkers. For Stepanov's wife, a stolid person, perhaps a little out of step with the times, Fattening those pigs was her main interest in life, as well as a prop for the family budget. Sunday was the day she had chosen for a trip to town with her husband in order to buy a piglet. This operation, successfully accomplished, was why Stepanov had not come to work that day, although Saturday's interview had left him ill at ease and impatient to be back at Marfino. That Saturday, in the political department, Stepanov had been given a shock. An official person, a very important one, round and rosy, there were roughly 280 pounds of him, in spite of the cares of office, had glanced at the spectacles mounted on Stepanov's narrow nose, and asked in a baritone drawl,
"Ah, Stepanov, what are you doing about the Hebrews?"
Stepanov pricked up his ears, unsure that he had heard correctly.
"The Jews."
And, seeing that the other man still did not understand,
"The Yids, then."
Caught off balance, and not daring to repeat that double-edged word, which not so long ago could earn you 20 years for anti-Soviet agitation, and at one time get you put against a wall, Stepanov mumbled,
Well... Well? What are you thinking of doing about them?
But then the telephone rang, the important senior comrade lifted the receiver, and their conversation was at an end. Stepanov anxiously read through a whole bundle of directives, instructions, and guidelines there in the department, but the black letters on white paper carefully skirted the Jewish problem. All that Sunday, as they went to buy the pig, he thought and thought, and clawed his chest in despair. Age had evidently dulled his wits. What a disgrace! An experienced party worker like Stepanov fails to spot a major campaign in the making, and even finds himself indirectly implicated in the intrigues of the enemy, because that whole Reutmann-Klikachov group... Stepanov arrived at work on Monday morning, not knowing what to think. After Shikin had said no to a game of billiards, Stepanov had planned to pump him. The full-time secretary, suffocating for want of instructions, locked himself in the party committee quarters, and banged the balls around for 2 hours on end, occasionally jumping one of them off the table. The enormous bronze bas-relief on the wall, the heads of the four founding fathers superimposed in profile, witnessed several brilliant shots with two or all three balls pocketed at once. But the silhouettes in bas-relief maintained their bronze impassivity. Three of the four each studied the nape of the genius in front, and not one of them suggested how Stepanov could avoid destroying a healthy collective and even reinforce it in the new situation. Exhausted, he heard the telephone ring at last and pounced on the receiver. The message was, first, that instead of the usual party and Komsomol instruction classes that evening, he should assemble everybody for a lecture on dialectical materialism, the progressive worldview, to be given by a lecturer from the Oblast Committee, and, second, that a car was even then on its way to Marfino with two comrades who would provide the appropriate guidelines for the campaign against kowtowing to foreign countries. The full-time secretary took heart, cheered up, doubled a ball into a pocket, and hid the billiards table behind the room divider. His spirits were further raised by the thought that the pink-eared piglet bought yesterday had eaten its swill eagerly, turning up its nose at nothing, both the night before and again that morning. There was reason to hope that it would fatten up quickly and cheaply.